I am fantasy and paranormal romance author Leslie Penelope, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Hello, friends. Today is Sunday, September 10th, 2023, and this is episode 221 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. So this week's best thing is I just literally just came back from this conference at Yale University, which was on popular romance. So it was romance fiction. My friend, my very good friend, Inez Johnson, who also writes as N.S. Johnson and several other pen names, is getting her MFA. And so now she's interested in all of these academic romancy things, but she wants to focus on romance writing. And so she was like, hey, there's this conference going on. Do you want to come? And originally it was like going to be like a road trip to Connecticut. And then we decided to take the train. And so I was like, yeah, sure. I'm not doing anything else. And that sounds interesting, even though I'm not like interested in the academic part of it. I did briefly contemplate getting an MFA. Very briefly, but I think I'm done with school. I'm not like a perpetual school goer. But yeah, it was actually really good. It was a really good energy. So the first day was Adriana Herrera and Sarah McLean giving this workshop on how to write romance. And it's always nice to sort of see how other people do things, you know? And you know, you can always learn something, even though like I've written romance novels or at least paranormal romance novels. I've never really tried my hand at a contemporary because that seems like it's another level. You know, with paranormal, you have external conflicts and I mean, you have that with contemporary, but you've got more built in conflict and it's much harder to write a contemporary. Any romance writer will tell you that finding good reasons in the modern day for these two people to be together, that's not just like a cliche, or even if you're doing a cliche, like doing it in a fresh, innovative way. Anyway, wonderful workshop. And then there are panel discussions. There was a screening of the documentary Love Between the Covers from 2015, which has been screened at several other conferences that I've attended, and I just never made it to watch it. So it was the first time I'm seeing it. And then afterwards, they had a discussion with Beverly Jenkins and Eloisa James, who were featured along with a number of other romance authors and readers and fans. And it's interesting because that documentary is a time capsule. It was filmed at several different RWA national conferences, Romance Writers of America, which famously at the very end of 2019 and all through 2020 went through its big implosion. Many, many, many people left. Many chapters disaffiliated over the past few years. And the organization still exists, but it is not anything close to what it once was. I'll see if I can dig up like an article going over what happened because I am not going to revisit it here. Then my former editor, Monique Patterson, who was at St. Martin's Press now, she's with Bramble, which is a new imprint, doing fantasy and paranormal romance or romantic plot lines. And they just launched last year. And so it was great seeing her again. I got to see some other authors and just meet some new people who were romance fans, bloggers and, you know, writers, journalists, people like that, the whole community in different parts, you know, people who are engaged in romance landy in different ways came together for this. And there were really interesting things that were talked about. One thing that I thought was interesting, and if the opportunity had presented itself, and if I had been able to formulate this as a question, I would have asked one of the panels. So author Adriana Herrera, who is fabulous, was talking about how romance is like a barometer of society. Like if you want to know about a society's opinions on gender, consent, things about the culture, relationships, look at romance novels. Romance novels of specific periods are like snapshots in time. In the same way that the documentary was, you can look at a romance novel from the 70s and the 80s and you'll see what the cultural mores were and what things were acceptable and what things weren't. And that shifts and changes. And it was said more than once that the genre is very fast paced. It moves very quickly because I think society also moves quickly. Like, you know, currently in 2023, there are words and phrases and things that you could say in 2019 that would be acceptable then to the majority of people, that right now to a large growing number of people are not acceptable. And some of that is great and some of that is questionable, in my opinion. I still have no problem with the term master bedroom, but HGTV has apparently decided that it's primary bedroom, and I think that sounds silly. Personally, I've never thought of master bedroom having anything to do with slavery, but I digress. So my thought about this idea that romance is a barometer of the culture is sort of balancing that with the editorial influence and the influence of the publishing industry. So it was brought up in another panel about Black romance, or they were talking about Black romance, and they had Dr. Julie Moody Friedman from the Black Romance podcast talking about interviewing, you know, Black romance authors and asking them questions about editorial interference, let's say. And a lot of them were asked to change things, and some did and some didn't. But usually if you didn't, you know, that book might not get published. And even I've talked to plenty of romance authors in traditional publishing with the big, you know, named romance publishers who were asked to change, you know, the career of their Black characters because it didn't seem Black enough. Like someone, a real romance author told me that a specific editor was like, why do you have this doctor and this lawyer together? That's not very realistic for Black people. You should change it to something else. Like these were things, you know, not too long ago that were being said. I don't know that anyone is going to say that in 2023, and hopefully maybe in the past couple of years. But how does the idea of romance presenting a snapshot of our life and culture match with the reality that so many authors, and I'm sure this happened to white authors in different ways too, and other authors of other races and all identities, to change things based on the editorial belief about what people wanted to read about. So much of what traditional publishing puts out is shaped by what they think will sell. And so they're looking at, well, what do people want to read? And for many, many years, the majority of romance readers were, you know, white middle-aged women, middle America. And that's reflected in the implosion of RWA. That's reflected in a lot of the things that weren't talked about at the conference. You know, they spent a lot of time and energy and effort talking about the representation. They had authors from different walks of life and different races and all of that. And they were very careful. And I know it was very curated to be like, this is the best of romance. But I think it was Katrina Jackson, who was there also, who said that, you know, what we're talking about, the wonder, the way that people laud romance, because we know it's been denigrated in culture. And so people who love it talk about all the benefits and the wonderful aspects of it. But Katrina Jackson also brought up that that's the minority. It's been the minority, and it probably still is the minority of romance. So we have a whole event, which, as I said, was lovely and inspiring, but is really only dealing with what we wish it all was, the portion of romance that we wish it all was, and not the majority that is still and has been problematic, for lack of a better term. And so, you know, maybe the answer to this is that, yeah, we're looking at this percentage of aspirational romance that is diverse and inclusive and not harmful. It's not showing you tropes that are damaging to someone's psyche or to the culture at large. It's not perpetuating stereotypes and like negative images and misogyny. And when we say, you know, romance is the language of hope, and it's about romance is revolution, and falling in love is, you know, revolution and all of this stuff, we're talking about the portion that is, that we kind of hold up, even if it's a smaller part, you know, it's not the majority of the genre. And I thought that was interesting. So to my knowledge, it wasn't recorded or anything, and I don't know if it'll ever happen again because it was put on by graduate students who I'm sure are graduating at some point soon. And, you know, they seemed very exhausted by it, but they did a great job. My writing update. So I got back to Brutal Fortress, the third book in the Bliss Wars trilogy, this week. And I was a little bit concerned. I talked about this last week about writing a romance, given my life circumstances, but it's going really well. I had to refamiliarize myself with the story, which I did, and kind of sink back into it. But I've been keeping a journal as the entire time I've been writing this actual written journal, because I've tried it with video before and that was great, but I have a hard enough time like trying not to repeat myself. So if I'm recording like private videos of like a diary for myself as I write the book and then I record the podcast, I don't know what I said when. If I'm talking to a camera, you know, I know I repeat myself a lot and I try to minimize it as much as humanly possible. But writing down like just bullet points after each writing session is really nice. And I can kind of go back through it and see what I was thinking through with the writing of this book. And so, yeah, I think I wrote down that it was going well. I was having fun. I was off script. You know, I have an outline and I'm an outline. I consider myself a plotter, even though I learned something new at this conference. And I think that either Sarah McLean or Adriana Herrera was talking about another romance author, Sierra Simone. We talked about plotters and pantsers. And according to Sierra Simone, if you're a little bit of both, you're a panty liner. So if you're an outliner and a pantser, you're a panty liner. And that is beautiful and lovely, and everyone needs to know this. So technically I am a panty liner because I outline and then I change the outline as I go. And I write, I go off script, off the outline, and then I try to wrangle myself back. And when I can't, I just rewrite the outline. I still consider that plotting though, because like a true pantser is probably not doing that. But like everything else in the world, as it seems, it's a spectrum. So I'll still claim plotter, but I will also claim panty liner because I think it's hilarious. I was averaging about 2,500 words a day, easing myself into it. I have not done a full, like, complete schedule. My eye is on getting the first draft done by the end of September and getting the revision done by October, which is aggressive. I mean, this book probably will take more than 1 month to revise, like, realistically, but that would be my hope. However, I did hear back from Orbit about the Black Towns book. And drumroll, please. We have a title. So the title of the Black Towns book, which that's what I've been calling it in public. In private, I've been calling it Black Atlantis. It is Daughter of the Merciful Deep. And that was on a list somewhere that got sent to the higher ups and came back. And I'm like, I'm fine with that. I think it works. I had some quibbles, but I do like it. I do think it works. And so we're moving on to the cover. So we have a new cover brief that my editor sent me, and hopefully the cover will be designed shortly. And I guess a reveal would happen sometime early next year, I would imagine. So things are moving right along for Daughter of the Merciful Deep. I did get a few more notes on the version that I sent in a few weeks ago. And I have a few weeks to incorporate those notes into the final draft. So I've had a couple of extra beta readers giving me feedback just to make sure that, you know, I made a big change the last time. And I need other people to read it and just make sure that it's okay. Like, you get a little nervous because in traditional publishing, a lot of times you read it and your editor reads it and then it goes into the world. And if I don't have time for beta readers, then I'm always like, did I do something wrong that we didn't catch, you know? And especially I've done two big revisions on this manuscript. So I've gotten feedback from one of my beta readers. Shout out to Shaheem, who did it quickly and amazingly. And I'm waiting for my brother, who is slow. And then I got some feedback from my editor's assistant. And so I'm thinking about that. And I wanted to talk about responding to editorial feedback when you have a very short period of time and like a small amount of feedback. So the notes that I just got back are like surgical notes about the story though. So it's not really line edits in terms of, we're not talking about sentences and changing words around. We're talking about story stuff, but it's still like laser guided surgery here because I have 3 weeks to turn this back in. And really I'm thinking about the problem that, you know, this editor saw. She had a solution, a possible solution that she threw out that I was like, okay, that's interesting. But there is some advice out there that says, someone tells you a problem, listen, if someone tries to tell you a solution, it's probably not right. But, you know, okay, what is the actual problem and how can I address that problem in a way that serves the story? Because a lot of times other people's solutions, and especially this one, like it doesn't quite do what I need it to do. You know, I lay things out very carefully and I have reasons for the things that are in there. And so I'm just thinking about, okay, problem that's been identified. Something is not working for this reader. what is the least amount of work I can do? Because everything has ripples. You throw a stone into the pond, it ripples out. I can't do a lot of damage because I can't do a lot of fixing in 3 weeks, but I can do laser guided surgery, right? I can do the robot surgery. And I've been sitting with the feedback for a few days in the back of my mind, just letting it cook. And actually, I was someplace where I wasn't on my phone. I wasn't listening to anything. I was just thinking, you know, sometimes, and I've talked about it on the podcast before, you just need time to think without interruption. So yeah, that's what I've been doing. And responding to editorial feedback, especially with a tiny window of time to do anything about it, it's really about, okay, I'm finding its voice. It's who is a character talking to? You know, I've got my main character who's first person POV, then I have these interstitials. And really right now we're talking about the interstitials, which are also first person. And it's got me thinking about, okay, who is this character talking to? This is the advice I got from Juno Diaz 10 years ago now. Who is she talking to? And I try to remember to think about that, but I don't always remember. And now it's like, oh, she actually needs to be talking to someone. And if I make that more clear, I feel like I can address the feedback, you know, because essentially the feedback boiled down to my main character wasn't getting some information until later, like 50% into the book. And the editor suggested have her get this information earlier. Can you seed it through more? And some of that is being done by these interstitials. And I feel like if I tweak the voice so that, you know, this narrator of these sections is speaking to my main character in a way that, and I have to figure out how the main character is hearing it. Or is it a reveal later on? Like, there's different narrative methods you can do. And I had to lay them all on the table and then choose one. So the first thing that came to mind was a dream. And I was like, okay, that's obviously the worst one. I can do better. So, you know, how can you get information from a mystical being, this, you know, spirit creature that is not a dream, that's not a vision, that is not something that just feels just done so much. I've done dreams, I've done visions, and I think they worked like in Song of Blood and Stone. But here, it just feels like it's the first idea that came to mind, and that's generally not the best one. I can dig deeper. So yeah, that's what I'm up to. I don't know what that means about Brutal Fortress, because, you know, the timeline is like, all my focus has to go to this. But while I'm in this period of letting things sit and, you know, letting my subconscious or whatever work on the problem, I can still work on Brutal Fortress. And maybe I can do two. I don't know. We'll see. Sometimes two works occasionally. It has in the past. Not recently, though. I just have to assess my energy. So yeah, that is the writing update. It's exciting. It's exciting for things to be moving forward and to have a title and to almost be at the final draft of this book that came out. So it was so difficult coming out. You know, I think another thing someone said at the event was some books are difficult and some books are easy. And I was like, which books are easy? And Inez turned to me and she was like, well, Song of Blood and Stone was easy. You wrote that in 2 days. I was like, the first draft, I spent a year and a half revising that book and doubling and eventually almost tripling the length of it from the first draft. Well, no, I mean, the first draft was 20,000 words, so it was way more than triple. The final draft of the paperback is 130,000 words. So yeah, and even the original version was 88,000 words. So nothing, some are easier than others, but easy? I've never had an easy book. Maybe Angelborn. Angelborn came out really easy too. Like my first two books, because I didn't know what I was doing and no one had read anything yet. And it's easier than the first book can be easier because there's no expectations other than your own. Speaking of which, I'm going to link this short video from Instagram Reels about perfectionism. It is by the late designer, Virgil Abloh, and the advice was wonderful. I am currently in my battle against perfectionism. I still want to have high quality and love it before I put it out into the world, but I know that my tendency towards perfectionism is not helpful, you know? And I think that's what this clip says. It's just not, it's not real. Like, there is no perfect, and I'm striving towards loving it, you know, and I guess that's perfect for me, but I can rein things in a bit. I can not go off the rails so much, which is what I'm trying to do. So that's it for me for this week. I have some events coming up on my calendar. I think I mentioned some last week. I will link to them. You can go to lpnlp.com/calendar for all the details. And my goals for the coming week: move forward on Brutal Fortress, move forward on the revision of Daughter of the Merciful Deep, and that's probably enough, right? Oh, I did have an announcement. I'm going to be doing something for Preptober. So Preptober is October. It's prepping for NaNoWriMo, which is November, National Novel Writing Month. And like literally today on the train, we were talking as we were coming back about doing NaNo. And hopefully I'll be done with Brutal Fortress. Even if I'm not, I can squeeze in 1,600 words a day. In theory, like, listen to me. I'm being very optimistic about all of this. But I did want to do something with my imaginary world building course for Preptober. So I decided editing videos is going to be too much stress. I'm going to go live twice a week, just sort of working through the imaginary world building process of world building a story with the goal of then drafting it in November. If you're interested in tuning in to watch me prep a new idea, like not brand new, this is something that I started a draft of years ago, but I'm coming back to, so I'm starting over from scratch. I'm going to be just going through the process that I teach in the course during October, live on YouTube, twice a week, I've decided. I come up with all of these lofty plans, probably because I'm sitting next to Inez, who, like, over the course of less than 48 hours, plotted 5 books and did like 2 proposals for academic papers to do at conferences, and then like did 15 other things. And I was just sitting here reading a book on the train and looking at her. She's like, every few minutes, I finished this thing, I did this thing. And I'm like, I am slacking. So it's good to have friends who inspire you to do great things and to be busy. And she is incredibly inspiring. So, but I'm excited about this. Preptober, October, live on YouTube. I don't have a link right now. I mean, it's going to be YouTube. So if you're watching this on YouTube, it'll be here. If you're listening to the podcast, I will put a link to my YouTube in the show notes and it'll be fun. So I'm putting it out there into the universe because I'm going to do it. I put it on my calendar. It's scheduled. It's going to be like 7 p.m. Eastern on Mondays. And what did I say? Checking my calendar now. Mondays and Wednesdays, because those times were free the entire month. So yeah, mark your calendars, 7 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to prep a story to write for NaNo. And that is it for me for this week. I hope that you have a wonderful week. For episode show notes and to sign up for the footnotes newsletter and get the show notes in your inbox, go to myimaginaryfriends.net, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, watch the video episodes on YouTube, email me at podcast@lpnlp.com, and I would really appreciate a rating or review to help support the show. My Imaginary Friends is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. For more fantastic podcasts, go to frolic.media/podcasts.